Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
So, Pete, what do you think the painting means?
Well, I'll tell you what. This time when I was watching it, there's something I really like about this painting. It's one of those kind of furniture paintings, right? One that's there mm-hmm. that you don't really see. It just sort of exists. And you almost have to force yourself to figure out what's going on in it. You know what I mean? Because it's supposed to just sort of blend in and make everything colorful and look nice. You know, it's nothing that's super in your face or engaging or anything. And so when I was watching it this time, I never really put two and two together that it's a man in a sail, you know, a man in a rowboat, pardon, that, you know, that's leaving his family behind, and they look pretty okay with it when you see them mm-hmm. standing there on the shore. So, I thought that it really made a big impression on me this time, the way that he's staring at it.
Yeah, so it's the painting, for those of you that need a reminder, it's the painting that is hanging in the hospital room that Walt is in after his fugue state. And it shows this man in a rowboat going out to sea, and there's a family standing on the shore waving goodbye, right? Like, it's sort of like a bidding him farewell sort of painting. And it's a painting that appears several times in Breaking Bad and also in Better Call Saul. So we see it in this episode, and it figures pretty largely in this episode. There are a couple of close-ups on it. Actually, the episode proper after the cold open opens on this very painting. It zoomed in, and then we zoom out, and we see Walt's face, and we understand he's in a hospital. And then he glances at it at a couple of really important moments in this episode. So when he's talking to the psychiatrist, and then when he comes back from sneaking into his own house to, you know, hide the money that was in the diaper box. And then we see it when he comes back, right? He's looking at that again. And we'll talk more about that later when we're actually talking about the episode. But it also figures in Better Call Saul in Fun and Games, which is season 6, episode 9, when Kim and Jimmy leave their apartment. So this is after the whole Howard debacle, and their apartment's been cleaned up. They go and stay at a motel. And Kim is laying down in a bed, and the painting, that same painting is on the wall behind her. But it's also in Breaking Bad in the 5th season in Gliding Overall.
Yeah, the one with where he meets Uncle Jack, right?
Yeah, where he meets with Uncle Jack and the neo-Nazis in the motel room, and they're planning out how to carry out the hit where he wants to kill like 11 people, right? And he glances at the painting again.
Can you remind me, this is the first time he ever meets Uncle Jack, right? This is the introduction.
Yeah. So if I remember correctly, he tells Todd that he thinks it's time to meet his Uncle Jack because he needs to solve this problem of Mike's 11 guys. He has to get rid of them. So he remarks on it in that meeting. So they're, you know, trying to figure out the logistics of how are we going to kill 11 men in jails, like across the state within a 2-minute window. And Walt's like distracted by this painting, and he's just staring at it until Jack comes over and starts snapping in his face. And Walt remarks that he's seen it before, and he ponders, like, do you think that this is like a painting that they have warehouses full of them or something like that. So like you said, Pete, at the beginning, like your impression is it's like one of those, it's very benign, right? It's like a wallpaper type painting. Mm-hmm. I did a little research on it, and it was actually commissioned specifically for Breaking Bad. So it's not like a real painting that exists somewhere and they just got prints of it. This was made specifically.
It's not the way that he describes it, huh? That they just have warehouses full of them somewhere.
That sort of, you know, generic benign painting that you might see in different locations like hotels or hospitals or whatever. But the painting that they commissioned for this is supposed to be in the style of the American painter Winslow Homer, who did a lot of like seascapes. And he did this one that's really famous, that's probably most most supposed to be based on. It's like of this man crossing the Gulf Stream. So I got a little bit into thinking about what the boat symbolizes, what that means in art, but also what it means for Waltz, right? So like, what does it mean historically in art speak, so to speak? And what does it maybe tell us about like Waltz's state of mind or Kim's state of mind in Better Call Saul, and how they use that painting to give us glimpses into what they're thinking?
Yeah, because just not to derail you there, but it is a very key crossroads for the character in Better Call Saul too, right? That moment when it's there is when she starts to contemplate that she can't be with Saul anymore, right? I mean, with Jimmy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So it definitely is foreshadowing of that breakup to come. And yeah. I think it has some slightly different meaning in Breaking Bad in both instances that he encounters it. So in this first time he encounters it in this episode, and then when he sees it later when he's in the hotel room with Jack. But just briefly, so in 19th century American art, the Romantics used a lot of like boat imagery. And so you have like John Singleton Copley, Washington Allston, of course, Winslow Homer, Albert Pinkham Ryder, among others, right? And traditionally, like the way the boats have figured in art is like it's, you know, very much about like man versus nature. And they're usually like one of two types of paintings. So you typically have the boat that has been wrecked, right? So we have like a shipwreck or a boat wreck, or you have the boat that's like caught up in a storm or a tempest sort of thing. Now, in this case, we don't really see that. It's kind of a placid thing. Like you see this guy going out to sea, but it's still, again, it's like, what do boats represent, in literature and in great art and things like that. So it's a venturing into the unknown, it's a farewell, right? So I think in context of Walt, something that he's been thinking about is like he wants his family to remember him fondly. This is a man who believes he's dying, and he might relate to that man in the boat who's saying goodbye to his family, and the family is happy to say goodbye, right? Like it's a kind of a melancholy but happy farewell. That it's not. In other words, it's not tumultuous. There isn't a tempest. There aren't storm clouds gathering over him. It's a peaceful farewell. And I found this article called The Iconography of the Boat in 19th Century American Painting. This was written by a guy named Gerald Eger. And I thought spoke about specifically with Homer, who this painting was supposed to be based on, was pretty interesting. So we see a little bit of that shift between like the shipwreck and the tempest-tossed ship in Homer's depictions of the boats and marine life and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And Eger says that Homer juxtaposes the qualities from the extremes of the boat imagery. So his method is essentially that of placing storminess next to sunniness, drama to detachment. So both imagery provided the opportunity to raising profound issues about man and nature, and this exploration of boats in art makes it possible for different artists to respond to these specific issues in pondering like about the fate of man, the character of the natural elements, and the relationship between the two. So traditionally, like paintings of boats and maritime culture and stuff like that, specifically in the 19th century, provides an answer in which it's like an unambiguous either yes or no sort of thing, where Homer is kind of in that gray area, right? It's like both yes and no. So he has he sort of breaks down that juxtaposition. I thought it was a really interesting way to think of what's going on with Walt and his boat in this particular episode.
Can he get it running again?
Why?
So we can cook.
You still want to cook?
Seriously.
What's changed, Jesse?
This is Growth Decay Transformation, a Breaking Bad rewatch podcast. I'm Courtney.
And I'm Pete.
And we're joined by our producer, Talitha Barco. Today, we will be discussing the third episode of season 2, which is written by Peter Gould, called Bit by a Dead Bee, which apparently comes from a line in the film To Have and Have Not. It's a variation of it. So I think the line from To Have and Have Not is stung by a dead bee. But the idea here is that the bee is Tuco, right, who wears a grill. So this bee bites. So, Pete, you want to give us a quick little synopsis of what happens in this one?
Yeah. After Barry and Tuco's gun, Walt and Jesse split up after they figure out a plan. Crucially, they don't reveal to us what that plan is. After Walt hops in a truck, leaving Jesse behind on the side of the road, it cuts to a supermarket where we see a confused employee discovering the trail of Walt's clothes on the floor. Ultimately, she discovers him standing there naked, and people are there and they've seen him, and it's a scene. He's taken to the hospital where he's reunited with Skyler and Walt Jr. His cover story is that he was in a fugue state and doesn't remember the time that went missing. At the DEA, Hank is debriefed by his superiors, and the fact that Tuco was already shot when he arrived after chasing down Jesse's car is brought up. Jesse makes it back and hooks up with Badger to get all their cooking gear out of his house. Badger hooks him up with his cousin, who's able to tow the car somewhere safe. The doctors at the hospital question Walt about what happened. He says he can't remember anything and tries to explain it away by it might be caused by all the medications he's on. They tell him they can't let him leave until they're confident it won't happen again. He could be out there in a situation where something bad happens because he's, you know, wandering around and not knowing where he's at. At the same time, the DEA kicks in the door to Jesse's room at the Crystal Palace where he's waiting for them with Wendy. You know, they're there so that he can establish his cover story for the days that are missing. Hank interrogates him and lets him know they are confiscating this giant bag of cash that he has. Jesse sticks to his story, as does Wendy, and Gomi says they have to let him go. Faced with the possibility that he might be stuck in the hospital for weeks or even months, Walt confesses to a therapist using doctor-patient confidentiality. He explains that he remembers everything, that he just had to get out of the house, and leaves out all the incriminating stuff that happened. Hank brings in Don Hector, but he's OG. He's an old timer. He won't work with the feds. After refusing to place Jesse at the shack, he craps in his pants as an additional FU to the DEA. Jesse tries to call his father for a ride and he doesn't come through. And then later he calls Walt from a payphone, who asks him if they can get the RV running so they can start cooking again. What's changed? His co-workers give Hank Tuco's grill and a Lucite cube, which he shows to Walt later as he's apologizing for putting Hank at risk. And then Walt returns home, and the episode ends with Skyler asking about the second cell phone before they go to sleep. So what did you think about this third episode of the second season of Breaking Bad?
I really, really love this episode. There's a lot I feel like I could say about this, but what the psychiatrist says to Walt when they meet in the hospital, he says, "So this is your way of giving credibility to a lie." And that's in reference to Walt admitting that the fugue state was completely made up. And it's a line that has always jumped out to me every time I've seen this episode. But absolutely. even more so in this one, though, because I think that it really helps us understand not just Walt, but a lot of what's going on with the characters in this episode with Jesse and Hank and so on and so forth. And it's something that I think also, if we think about maybe perhaps like the themes woven throughout this episode and in Better Call Saul as well, we talked a little bit about the painting at the beginning. I think what Kim and Jimmy do in that particular episode in Fun and Games is also giving credibility to a lie, right? They have to have their alibi for where, you know, they were the day after whatever happened with Howard. But last week we talked about one of the things that this show does so well is it backs characters into corners and then it shows us how those characters manage to get out of those corners. And it's another type of process. And this is one of those process videos that shows each step in the plan. And in this case, both Walt and Jesse have to tell their stories or their alibis to explain their disappearances. But in this mix of, I guess we could call it like truths and lies that they tell, I think it's a really interesting examination of the characters' identities. And Walt is very much still deluding himself into thinking what he does, he's doing for his family, though he seems to, it seems almost intentional that he's ignoring the harm that he's causing them, and he's confronted with it in with the reality of the harm that he's caused them in some subtle and really poignant ways in this episode. So like that painting that we see hanging in the hospital room, or the missing poster at the bus stop, or even seeing Skylar and Junior in the kitchen as he's hiding in Holly's room looking at them, and they don't know he's there. So it's but he's still like, he refuses to acknowledge his culpability in causing that harm, or I guess owning up to any sort of responsibility. What about you? What did you think about this one?
Yeah, I mean, I agree on all those points that you have there at the end, and ditto on the process episodes, the what, you know, where we see them work through things. What I really liked about this episode, rewatching it, is how they don't reveal the plan to us, you know, whenever Jesse and Walt split up. The way that they decide, or I guess like the way that they dedicate this much time to having this unfold that way, like the way that we see it play out, is it leaves room for so many great moments, because the thing is Tuco, right? I mean, that's the big event, was this showdown at Tuco's shack. And how do you follow that up? Well, you could just move on to the next big thing, or you could do what they do here, which is show how it affects the characters, show how they respond to it, how they have to. I mean, you have this new thing, you know, he has this problem he has to deal with, Walt, because he just disappeared from his house. And so, you know, there's a lot of interesting details in how he puts his plan together and everything else. But it's really about, I think, the way that they, you know, there's this, the sequence of the grocery store worker where she's finding each one of his pieces of clothing, mm-hmm. as she's, you know, she's discovering one and then another. And it's sort of like she's following this path that's been laid out for her. And I really like how that sort of sets the stage for how all of this is put together. There was a thing that I read, and I couldn't find it when I was getting ready for this. There was a thing that I said about, I think it was an interview with Peter Gould, where he was talking about planning things out and explaining the plans to the audience. And he said something to the effect of, you don't really need to explain it if it's successful, because you're going to watch it actually play out. But I think like that makes perfect sense, you know, hearing him say it, and you see the result of it here. It's excellent. But I don't think that a lot of shows, especially a lot of shows at the time that this came out, did it that way. You know what I mean? So it's, there's a ton of great stuff. Like I go back to that scene of him with the therapist, where he has that sort of long pause after he asks him about doctor-patient confidentiality. And he thinks about he's sort of taking the temperature, like, what can I say here to get out of this? What can I say here that's going to help me? What can I avoid saying to kind of minimize my exposure and everything else? And it's all really subtle stuff. Like you said, that one line jumps out at you, lending credibility to a lie. It does that. It's effective in a way that you don't really understand until much later. Or at least I didn't.
Yeah. And what's so interesting about that scene in particular is he's telling half-truths, right? So he admits that the fugue state was completely made up, but he's lying about like where he actually was when he was in this alleged fugue state, right? Of course, we know he was, you know, in the desert with Tuco and Jesse, but he tells the doctor a really convincing story about how, like, you know, who wouldn't run, Doc? You know, I'm dying of cancer. I have a baby on the way. My son has cerebral palsy. I've, you know, been out. You know, all of my friends and colleagues have far surpassed me. I'm overqualified. So it's like his long list of grievances, which are valid, right? That anybody could or would understand. But those aren't really the things that are.
Yeah, it's a good.
Directly
lie.
Anyway, yeah.
It's a good lie that makes sense because it's grounded in realities, the realities of his life, but it's also totally a smokescreen for what's really going on.
Yeah, it is. And this idea of stripping down again. So I don't know if we should count this as one of our tidy whitey counters. I mean, the supermarket employee does pick up his tidy whiteys. That's the last thing that she finds. So, and I, again, like UP, I love that sequence.
One,
like,
that's
versus
the one
the
detail
shoe.
That almost takes me out of it, because I'm like, would she really pick up the tidy whiteys, or would that be the part where she just looks up and says, wait a minute, what's going on here? But the actor and the way that it was shot, everything works. So it doesn't really take me out of it until I just sort of think about it. But also, we talked about it, I think, a couple of weeks ago, but you can see the pink teddy bears in that shot too. So that's a pretty fun one, that they're on the sort of on the aisle end cap there, hanging in the side.
Yeah. The little Easter egg. So yeah, I noticed that. I don't think I ever noticed it before. We talked about it when it was that in 737, I think, first time we see it. I don't think I'd ever noticed any of the other instances of the teddy bear apart from like what we see in those cold opens. Take a break. Wander around in a fugue state. We'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Tight. We're back with more DDT. But yeah, it's interesting what you were saying about with Peter Gould, because I think one of the things that this episode that does is really interesting is it's in many ways a quiet episode. There's a lot of introspection and some quieter moments, like even in that that sequence with Jesse and Walt in the beginning in the cold open as they're walking through the desert, and we get those really neat overhead shots of them. There's which reminded me a little bit of Bagman with Mike and Jimmy trekking through the desert. So you know, you get some of these quieter moments, and then with Walt sitting in the hospital room staring at this painting and things like that. And one of the other things, I think it's a very visually interesting episode. There's a lot going on. It was really, let me just say this up front, it was really, really hard to pick a favorite shot for this one, because I think there's some really, really excellent moments in this whole episode. But something that really stood out to me is this idea of barriers. We see a lot of barriers in this one. So there are a lot of moments with the characters where they're behind like glass in some cases. So like when Marie and Skylar are talking on the phone, right? After Walt has been found, we see Skylar first through like two sets of double glass sliding doors at the hospital.
Naked. She says naked like five times in a row without any other words or something like that.
It wasn't Whole Foods, was it? Marie asking the important questions, right?
Yeah, as far as the barriers, I noticed that the way they set that up in the hospital, especially with that. You know, she's looking at Hank from behind a window where he's in another room behind another window. There's
DA office. Yeah,
there's like layers of walls barriers in between them right there. But they're transparent. She can see through them, but they still feel so incredibly far away because of the way that that's set up.
Yeah, and then we also see it later when Jesse is standing outside of, I guess it's the police department, wherever he was interviewed, maybe, and he's calling his dad. So we're on the inside of the building. I guess that's the same office as where the DEA is. Yeah. And he's on the outside talking to his dad, and we see him through there. We also get this shot of Jesse and Badger behind the gate at front of Jesse's house as they're moving things into the RV, their equipment from the basement into the RV. So there's a lot of really interesting moments of these sorts of barriers. And I was just thinking of, like, thematically, like what that might add to the storyline. So these characters, there's a distance between them. And to come back to that boat, right? Like, there's this gulf or this distance between, like, Walt and his family. So and thinking, so we talked a little bit at the beginning in that of this episode about the significance of boats in, like, 19th century American painting, but, like, what does it mean to Walt, particularly in this episode, and how does it really help us understand what's going on with his character? So I already kind of floated the idea that maybe that's how Walt wants to think of himself, like, you know, going off to sea. Maybe that's like a metaphor for him going off to death, right? And his family is bidding him farewell. But it also, I think, in some ways is like Walt's Rubicon. He has already arguably, like, crossed barriers that he cannot, you know, come back from. But another point that I thought was really telling is, like, when he tells Jesse, like, what's changed. Like, his idea is to keep going forward, like, full speed with what they're already doing, like, in spite of everything that has happened. Like, he's not taking all these things into stock, and he's not really taking into consideration how what he's doing is affecting his family into consideration. So, and he has these, like, constant reminders of, like, the missing poster at the bus stop, mm-hmm. of seeing, I think it's such a sad scene. It really is such a gut-wrenching scene to rewatch, of Skylar and Junior in the kitchen in the morning when Walt is hiding in Holly's room. And they're comforting, well, Junior is comforting his mom, and they're clearly, like, they're up early. It's still dark out. It's not, like, in a natural time that they would normally be awake. So these are people that have been traumatized. So, I think, you know, as a viewer, like, I'm empathizing with them and what they've been through in missing Walt this whole time. And he's confronted with that, but it doesn't seem to, like, register. Like, it, I don't know if he's, like, willfully ignoring.
I think we kind of touched on this in 737 too, but that's one of the things I was thinking about, and I don't want to jump ahead too much and go completely out of order, but when he comes home, you know, like, he's created this narrative that he just had this incredibly harrowing situation, you know, that he forgot where he was, and he showed up naked at the thing, but, you know, his family is there for him, and they, of course, they would be, but you see that disconnect in the fact that they're the ones that are actually traumatized by it. Like, he's actually, when he gets there, he's relieved that he's finally made it home, that it all worked. You know what I mean? Like, he actually went through something traumatic, you know, that happened at Tuco's place. You know what I mean? Like, he thought he was going to die for 2 days. Like, that's serious. Like, I don't think that is something that he'll forget anytime soon. But in the context of that final coming back home, you know, where you could see just that look of relief on his face, like, wow, as crazy as it all was, I came up with the right plan, and I got it to work, and everything's fine. So now we can just move on. You know, it's the same thing that he's telling the doctors at the hospital, where they're saying, you know, actually, it's not okay. We have to figure out why this is happening, because, you know, you might end up getting shot by a cop somewhere if you're walking around in a fugue state or whatever. So yeah, there's that really great disconnect of, like, you know, what he needs to do, like, you know, where his desperation, like, the way that he sees himself as being in this desperate state where he has to get this money in time to, you know, make things okay for his family after he's gone, and, you know, how that affects everyone else, and how he just fails to register that. And to really quickly go back to the boat, you know, what I think about that, and, you know, thinking about it in the context of this episode, and thinking about, you know, like, the things that you brought up earlier about where it shows up again, and how they use it even in Better Call Saul. What I thought about that, you know, what I was thinking about when I was looking at it, was that distance that's between him and his family, the man in the boat and his family on the shore. In Walt's situation, that is, it's manufactured, you know, it's there because he put it there. And he's unwilling to, you know, in Walt's case, of course, he's going to die. All that's going to happen because of his cancer. But he could just turn the boat around and just go back and just live out the rest of his life with his family. But he chooses to keep that that distance in place. And he chooses to continue on that path of like separating himself from his family. And, you know, I hadn't really thought about it in context of the entire episode as much as I did this time when I watched it.
Yeah, I actually went back and I watched, obviously I watched this episode for the podcast, but I went back and I watched just that one scene from Gliding Overall where it shows up again in that motel room. And I was, and the painting, it's the same painting, but it's like discolored. It's kind of mm-hmm. yellowed and it looks like it's been, you know, it's kind of worse for wear a little bit. It looks
It looks like people have been
muted.
In there smoking yeah. cigarettes for a couple decades before he got there.
Exactly. So it's a little bit degraded, right? So I thought that was a really interesting choice. And of course, the motel room that they're meeting in is real skeezy too, right? So like it sort of matches the atmosphere of the room. But I was looking at the painting, and of course, my first impression is this is a man going off to sea. But I imagined like you could also consider it as a man returning to shore, depending on how you look at it, right? So I was thinking maybe for that one in... that happens in season 5, because like given what is going on in Walt's life at that time, like he's trying to wrap everything up. He's trying to solve all his problems, you know, clean up like the 11 guys issue that were left over from Gus and Mike, and ultimately like retire and be able to go live his life in suburbia with his wife and kids, right? Like, so it's a man trying to come back, but it's so degraded and it's just impossible at that point. So I think that's like maybe another way of reading this painting further down the line. So, I mean, it's up to everyone to sort of interpret, you know, any way they want to.
Let me ask you a question about this. Is where he is right now, is it possible for him to turn the boat around if he wanted to?
I mean, it's a tricky question, right? Could he? Like, of course he could, but it does he... but. I don't know. That is a good question. So, I mean, I think at this point, though, he's so driven and so blind to what's the reality of things around him that he is determined and set on this particular course. So I think, like, yes, he could turn the boat around, but it doesn't seem like that's really an option, given, like, because everything that's happened.
I mean,
okay,
he killed
yeah,
a
everything
man.
That's
he killed,
happened.
He killed
yeah.
Crazy Eight, right? So, I mean, you know, like, if he turns the boat around, is doing that all for nothing then? You understand
well,
what
yeah,
I'm saying?
I think
like,
that's...
I'm not saying it's sort of an experiment of putting ourselves into his frame of mind, not like what's actually morally correct or makes sense or anything like that. You know what I mean? But yeah, like in his mind, in the way that he's been presented to us, you know, he's been they've very specifically crafted this narrative around this character, right? Like, is there a way that he could, you know, that just could end a different way? You know, I mean, it's pretty much like there's, if we think about him as that man in the boat, like there's a lot of momentum behind that little bit of distance that from the shore, right? And I don't know that I feel like that there's almost we're almost at a point of no return, but I don't know. I just it's kind of fun to think about.
Well, I think, you know, I mentioned earlier that I think of that boat as Walt's Rubicon, right? Like it is the crossing that barrier. There he is beyond the point of no return, so to speak. And I mean, he's had several instances, moments, of course, like in Grey Matter, for example, where he could have, you know, changed course if we want to, you know, continue with the sort of Mariner type of metaphors here. Like he could have you know, charted a different path for himself. He's had several different opportunities, but I think at this point he really is too far gone. And that line that he says to Jesse, like, after everything, he's like, what's changed? So now to just do the thought experiment, right? Like putting ourselves in Walt's shoes, like how is he rationalizing this? Is this because he's already gone this far? Like, what does it matter at this point? Like, is it beyond him or what's driving him? I still think that he at this point is thinking he's doing this for his family. Like, we know that's not really true at this point. Like, it's beyond that. He's doing this because he's getting something more out of it. He's mm-hmm. feeling powerful and it's gratifying in other ways for him. But that is still the story that he's telling himself. And it's again, giving credibility to that lie. Right. So that's That's why I love that line so much that the psychiatrist says, because everything he's doing is giving credibility to this lie, that he's doing this for, you know, for good reasons, to leave his family with like a nest egg or in a good position when he dies.
He's getting better at it too, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think you can see in this episode that his lies are better. His confidence, the way that he sort of maneuvers the situation, he's becoming a better criminal, a better liar. I think it's pretty clear. It's not a small situation. I mean, like I said at the end of last episode, like how's he going to get out of this? You know, that's the question that you have. And he does that pretty effectively. I mean, of course, his plan goes wrong. It runs into all kinds of problems that he didn't anticipate, like that they wouldn't just let him out of the hospital and that this was going to lead to more questions. But he, in the end of the day, he navigates that pretty successfully, too. I wanted to know what you thought, like whenever the family comes in. And he starts to sort of break down in tears and do that. Do you think that rang true to them?
I think it did for Skylar.
Do you think That's what I was wondering. Like, I mean, I think Walter Jr. is actually pretty interesting in this episode, because as a teenager, like you find out your dad showed up naked at a supermarket. Like, that's not easy to sort out. Like, that there's a lot going on in your head whenever you hear that story, you know what I mean? Like, in a way that it's very specific to being a young person, like a teenager, you know what I mean? Like, but I mean, for, I was wondering what you thought of if Skylar bought into that. I mean, I know that she's there like emotionally, like she's definitely like really happy to see him come back, but I mean, I feel like it's a little bit over the top the way he does it, but it seems to go under the radar as far as I could tell.
I think it does initially, right? I think when they come in, they're just grateful to see him. I mean, their concern was real, right? He was missing. He's sick. He has cancer. He's been depressed as far as they're concerned, right? So they're, you know, she was thinking the worst. I mean, we talked a little bit about this in the last episode. A lot of people were wondering if he could hurt himself, right? Like, is that what happened? Did he go off and harm himself in some way? So I think it's genuine for sure. But then certainly by the end of the episode, Skylar's a little bit like, you know, what about this second cell phone sort of thing? Mm-hmm. And the Walt's, you know, like his mask slips a little bit. So like, you know, he's trying to, I mean, he's like belaboring the point that he's okay, right? Like he didn't really think it through. And that's part of his problem. Like, he's not thinking through how these things are going to affect his family. But also, like, this particular story being in a fugue state, showing up naked in a supermarket is serious, right? Like, he didn't really think about like what the consequences of that might be, like needing something like a psychiatric evaluation, or how like his family would continue to worry about him.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of, yeah. So he didn't really think it through. And so I think one of the, I mentioned this already, right? Like, he's not really considering other people at all. He's not thinking about how what he does affects his family. And I don't know. I mean, I guess like in the moment, like he had to come up with a story. He had to come up with a plan to get out of this situation. And that was the best he could come up with under those circumstances. But to your point, right, with Junior and a teenager, we do see that play out in a future episode, right? Like, where around school, the kids are making fun of Walt. Someone puts up one of the missing posters in Walt's windshield in front of the school, where it's, you know, they have the little speech bubble where it's like, I lost my pants or something like that, you know? And that's something that Junior has to deal with. Mm-hmm. And like, Walt isn't really capable, I think, of thinking about how like any of these things ultimately affect his family. But again, like, given like, you know, what were his alternatives? What else could he have done to get out of this situation?
Yeah, I'm with you in what you're saying, but at the same time, I keep finding myself saying though, like, what else would he have done kind of thing? You know what I mean? Like, he kind of, the, it all goes back to the original sin of entering this life, right? Like, all of these things are out of his control, and he's reacting. He's not really making a lot of this stuff happen in real time, right? I mean, he, you know, like, if you think about it, he was sitting there talking to his wife, the last time she saw him. And he was whisked away, you know what I mean? So, like, yeah, it's a I totally agree that, like I said, with what you're saying there. But I think also what makes it compelling is that he really doesn't have a lot of options. You know, like they're walking through the desert after a shootout and, you know, something they could be implicated in. Jesse's car is still there. You know what I mean? Like they do, like, when I was thinking about it, I was like, damn, he makes Jesse go through a pretty harrowing situation here. And I'm thinking, like, you know, like, is that really necessary? But in a way, it kind of is, because of the fact that they have Jesse's car with a bag of money and, you know, everything that was right there on the scene. So they do have to have some kind of, you know, outrageous story in a way, so that it sort of takes away from the reality of it. Because, I mean, Hank could very easily connect the dots here, right? I mean, like, he's thinking
he should be able to.
Yeah, you know what I mean? I'm looking for my brother-in-law who disappeared. I come across this car from his known associate that's at this place, and it leads to a shootout. And then he comes back mysteriously the next morning after being in a fugue state, you know?
That answers your question, Pete, about, like, could he actually turn that boat around? And I think no, right? Like, because that probably would have been the best moment for him to do that, because he could have come up with a story at Tuco's hideout when Hank shows up and he, you know, gets that effective kill shot on Tuco. He could have said that they were being held hostage and forced to cook, and, like, he could have made up this whole story, right, about how Tuco, you know, somehow got Walt to do, you know, be his cook for him, or, you know, could have explained another story and he could have gotten out of it. Now, that would have ended the show. It would have been, you know, wah, wah, sort of ending to it, but he did have other choices. And I was thinking of, like, the scene that you're talking about in the previous episode when he's talking to Skyler. And it's almost like he really is at a loss, and he really is, you know, in too deep. Like, it is, like, over his head, so to speak, really. And I believe him when he tells Skyler, like, I don't even know where to begin. Like, he really is distraught in that moment. And then that's, of course, when Tuco and Jesse come pulling up and they make him get in the car.
How close do you think he is to revealing the truth of the situation, both in that moment whenever he has her, when he's sitting on the side of the bathtub, and then again when he's with the therapist? Because he could have just unburdened himself in that situation too and said, look, this is what's going on. Because there is, you know, I don't think a sane person would probably trust in patient doctor that confidentiality or whatever, but he could unburden himself to someone. And I mean, how close do you think he was to doing that with Skyler, and then again whenever he's with the doctor or the therapist?
I think he was closer with Skyler. I don't think there was any way he was going to tell the doctor the truth. He was telling the doctor what he needed to tell the doctor to get out of the hospital, sort of thing. And, you know, I don't think at this point he actually feels the need to unburden himself of anything. It's not like this is weighing heavily on his conscience or anything. I think he was burdened when he thought Tuco was going to kill his family, and he walked into his house and he was worried that, like, you know, he may have already gotten to Skyler or Junior in the previous episode. So I think that was a different scenario. But now that he knows that the threat has been eliminated, Tuco is dead, there's no way. And he even tells Jesse, what's changed? Those are, like, the two most important lines in this episode to me. So this is your way of giving credibility to a lie. And then when Walt and Jesse are speaking later, and he says to him, you know, what's changed? Like, we're going to keep going forward and doing this. As far as he's concerned, like, you know, the problem has been solved and he wants to keep making his money. I mean, he's in the hospital, like, figuring, going through the numbers again. And then he remembers cash on hand, which is what leads him to sneak back into the house to you know, rehide his money out of the diaper box. So, yeah, at this point, I think he is kind of a lost cause. He's on that path of no return, for sure.
And it works, because the way he sees it from his perspective, his point of view, is that all this stuff is kind of happening to him, right? Like, he made what in his mind was a reasonable decision to do this thing and make this money. It's something that he needs to do. It's something that's necessary. And, you know, he just can't believe the bad luck he's been having with these, you know, these crazy characters like Tuco and these situations. And you know what I mean? Like, in his mind, this isn't all about the choices that he made and the way that they affect everyone else. It's about how it just hasn't worked out the way that it should yet. You know, I guess I just got to make sure I do it a little bit better so that I get better results.
Yeah, he doesn't learn, does he?
No.
He's, you know, just going to keep going forward. And I don't know, it reminds me a little bit of Jimmy, again, in that same episode, because I ended up watching a huge part of it, Fun and Games, the one where this painting also appears, where Jimmy's pleading with Kim that he'll change, things will be different going forward, but they're not, right? Like, these characters can't actually change or improve. It's always like kind of like two steps forward, one step back, and they can't betray like their own like identity in a way, I guess. And like this is who Walt really is.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned earlier that it's a quiet episode, and I think what's interesting about this one is that they balance that out. You know, I mean, I think they do a pretty good job of making the plan and the reveals of what's happening really compelling. But rather than balancing the character stuff with action, I thought they did a really good job of doing it with comedy, like with funny moments in here. There's like a lot of little situations I really kind of laughed at whenever I was watching it.
Oh yeah, like with Badger and Jesse in the basement. Yeah. Badger has some great lines.
Yeah, that this was a bad choice. Whenever he has the gas mask on, whenever they carried the methylamine, and they don't roll it either. They carry it just the same way that they did. But yeah, I love the line delivery there of "this was a bad choice" as he takes the mask off. I really liked Marie, whenever she says naked, 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 you know, like she just can't get past that word in their conversation.
About that moment with Marie, because we've talked a little bit about some of the similarities between Walt and Marie. And I think that moment, right? So Skylar and Marie are talking and they've just found Walt and he's okay. And then like, but what is Marie hung up on? She's concerned that he was found naked and she's worried about what grocery store it was in. And she's like worried about all the wrong things.
Yeah.
And then I think about, I think of that as like an interesting mirror of the conversation that Walt and Jesse have. It's the first time they've spoken since they, you know, part ways in the desert. And, you know, Jesse's telling Walt about how, like, you know, the cops picked him up and everything and they sweated him and stuff like that. And what's Walt's concern? His concern isn't like, you know, is Jesse okay? Is Jesse safe? It's, did they ask about me? What did Walt say? Or what did Hank say? You know, so it's like, again, like they're, I thought that was a really interesting little parallel between Walt and Marie and how like what they're concerned about and what they're fixated on is so like, I don't know, removed from like what actually people should be concerned about. But I don't know, maybe to your point, right? Like, you know, we've been talking a lot about appearances and like disappearances and stuff like that. And Marie is kind of calling it out as she sees it sort of thing. And of course, the truth is that the whole thing was bullshit. It was all a lie. There was no real fugue state.
Yeah.
But the expectation is that everyone be concerned about Walt and show appropriate care and compassion and things like that. And you should, right? Like if you really believe that this is something somebody went through. So I think a lot of these interactions reveal a lot about the individual characters. And it's very much a character study episode, I think. And I mean, we have all these like cool, like visual things with those barriers and the distance represented between those barriers and like with the painting itself. I don't know. It's a great character study one though. And I think like there's some really interesting stuff going on with Hank too. And at one point, like when Marie and Skylar are talking, Skylar asks how Hank is and Marie says, you know, Hank, he's indestructible. And Hank again is putting on this facade of the tough cop and everything. And at the end, when they bring out the cake and they give him Tuco's grill encased in the lucite block or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, he talks about how much he loves it. But of course, later down the road, we know that isn't really true. Like, this really haunts him. And so, Pete, you mentioned in our last episode that this was the first time we ever actually saw, like, someone get, like, killed by a gun, right? Like, actual exchange of fire in that way, and that particular kind of violence. And we spoke a little bit about, like, you know, Hank and his whole, you know, face, his whole tough cop act that he puts on. And that mask is also going to start slipping pretty soon. So I don't know. I think this was really interesting about, like, what the characters show, like what they the face that they wear with their families and so on and so forth. And then, like, a look at who they really are, though. Something on a more subtle way with Jesse and his dad. You know, Jesse's telling his dad about how, like, he's, you know, looking into data entry and he's amped up. And I mean, that's all a lie, too, right? He's telling his dad what he thinks his dad wants to hear.
Yeah. It's a sad Jesse episode. You know, it's the beginning of, you know, you're talking a lot about Hank and how his trajectory has changed. And it's for Jesse, too, right? I mean, this is where we start to see a lot of the negative effects that it has on him, his association with Walter. I think you start to see that, you know, the hints of that, at least in this episode.
Well, yeah, it definitely puts Jesse and Hank on that collision course. Mm-hmm. This is the first time
they have that little stare down right outside the room at the Crystal Palace. That's definitely setting some stuff up for down the road.
Definitely. Some great stuff with Hank. You know, the way that he gets interviewed by the DEA for, like, the official record of, you know, what happened. I love that whole scene. And he's the way, like, the sort of cop jargon that he uses, the way he describes what happened with Tuco, and he was able to take an effective shot and, you know, was able to ascertain that the suspect, blah, 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 blah. I thought that was really, really cool. And again, like, this idea of, like, public face, private face. So, like, that's, like, the official DEA face. But then when they turn off the tape recorder, then they're like, you know, well, you know, thank God that piece of shit's, you know, taken out of the world, sort of thing. And then, like, the real macabre celebration of encasing his grill in, like, you know, a block of lucite. So I think, I mean, maybe perhaps too much on the nose in this idea, this sort of bifurcation of, like, what we think we are versus what we really are.
It's a weird thing, the choice to make that a totem in a way, isn't it? Like, do you think people really do that sort of thing? I mean, it's not. I never really thought about it too deeply because it works so well as a device throughout Hank's story. But the whole idea of taking his grill and putting it in that block like that, it's really a creepy thing to do whenever
like psychopathic. I mean, it's like keeping a trophy from a murder victim.
It really is. It's like a serial killer's trophy. They're like, yeah, look at this, you killed that guy, remember killing him, remember how you thought you might die and how you decided to use lethal force to kill him first. You know,
yeah, a notch on his belt. And you know, I think that was an intentional obviously an intentional choice. So again, like, I think of that conversation that Walt and Hank had when they're talking about, like, what's legal versus what's illegal. This was in a previous episode when they're outside barbecuing. You know, like, what might be legal now versus, you know, in the future, sort of thing. So this idea of, I don't know, like, being on, like, a commentary is that, like, is the DEA really any different from, like, a serial killer keeping their trophies? I don't know. It's gruesome. It's definitely gruesome. And I mean, also in the previous episode, or was it the one before? No, I think it was, the two ago where Hank takes the photo with Gonzo at the junkyard where his arm gets ripped off and he went stumpy in the photo. It's so macabre. It's so, it's so dark. But, you know, like that sort of gallows humor, I think, isn't uncommon to people in that line of work, right? Like, it's they deal in such a darkness, I guess. Like, you have to have a sense of humor about it. I mean, it's repulsive to us, of course, but
yes,
I don't
know. Yeah, I mean, I get where you're coming from, but yeah, it's pretty rough. And, you know, they make it that way, too. I mean, those guys, like, the kind of personality that Hank has, you know, you can understand why they would think that would be a good present for him, You know what I mean? That's the way he carries himself, is that he's a badass, mm-hmm. And he, you know, that these guys deserve to die. And that's just the way things are divined. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those episodes that I think really, like, besides its big moments, you know, besides the big, you know, the big conversation with the therapist and everything, I think it's one of those ones that it really does, it really does take on a lot more, you know, it gets a lot better when you watch it the second time or the third time or the fifth time or wherever, whatever number we're on now. Right. And, you see how it fits into the progression of what they're doing. It's a really neat little place, because, you know, you do, whenever I like the idea of when you have a big event, when you have this big, you know, existential situation for them in the last one, I like the idea of being able to step back and, see how it, you know, see how it plays out across the different characters and the way that they react to it, rather than just hopping into the next thing. I mean, there, you know, this show picks up a lot of momentum in the fourth and fifth seasons, you know what I mean? But like in the beginning, mm-hmm. All of this work is what makes that ring true, right? You know, like that you can, if you do the work now, if you build the foundation, then you can really go into a different gear, and everything has, you know, everything has a different, it means more because the character, we know who the characters are or whatever. And, you know, I was thinking about it when I was watching it today, about how much of the story is not involved at this point still, you know what I mean? Like, I was just thinking about, you know, we haven't met Saul Goodman. We haven't met Gus Fring, Mike Ehrmantraut, like some of these like really big parts of things that are yet to come. And, you know, you think, how long could they have really made it just about Walt and Skyler? And, you know, because we lost an antagonist pretty quickly, right? So how long could they make it just about the family stuff? And when you watch this closely and you think about it, they could have probably done it for quite a while if they set their mind to it, you know?
Yeah, they could have. But I think they've sort of established this pacing of this like high moment, low moment, just like the name of the supermarket mm-hmm. that Walt walks into, high, low. Mm-hmm. So the last episode was a high moment, right? Like they get rid of Tuco. It is a sort of a resolution episode. This guy that they thought was going to kill him has now been killed and they're safe. They're alive, right? So like that problem has been solved. And so now we're in this low moment. And again, like, but, you know, instead of just showing us like the next big action scene, they do bring us back to the family, and they do make sure that that is a really important part of the story that they're telling. It's not just this like one guy in his quest to become like this, like, you know, this meth super king, you know, and build his empire or whatever. Like they really take their time to show us the effects and the way that this ripples through his personal life. And I really appreciate these more quieter or low moments to see, because, like, you know, like it was such a big ending to the previous episode. And then, like, how do you top that? How do you, like, where do you go from there, right? So, like, they had to tell this story. Now, most other shows probably would have, like, made it, like, you know, like maybe a 5-minute long storyline. And then mm-hmm. they would have gone on to the next big thing, another big, like, action moment or something like that. But they didn't do that here. And they really take us through the motions of what happens to these characters and trying to now extricate themselves from this situation. So to your question though, like, could they have done this for longer? I think they do. I think it's a really good balance throughout the series where they show
obviously
us, like,
they do have it mixed in there, you know?
Yeah, I think it's just as important to the story, if not maybe more important than some of those more exciting action scenes with the cartel world and the drug business and stuff like that. I mean, those are the really cool, like, explosions and, like, you know, the real tense moments and stuff like that. But it's also, you know, it's a more subtle, perhaps, type of tension. But I really enjoy seeing the family dynamic and seeing what happens to these characters. I know a lot of people don't like they hate the family. They hate, like, you know, all the sort of subplots and storylines following the family. But to me, I think you can't really have one without the other. Like, I wouldn't care to watch a show about just a bunch of drug dealers.
Yeah, that was what my point was, is that you can afford yourself all of that, like, just, you know, over the top, silent, you know, menacing cousins from Mexico that come and you think they might cut your head off, all of that kind of stuff. You can afford yourself all that stuff because of what they're doing here, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it would be a different show without it. And I mean, just speaking personally, of course, I mean, that's all we can never really speak. For me, the reason why I love this show so much is because of those character studies. And it's why I love Better Call Saul so much, and why I think Better Call Saul is so great, because they really do a lot of really interesting character study and really take their time showing us what happens to those characters. And I guess, you know, different people have different tastes and what they enjoy watching. I like both. Now, I'm not a big action fan in general, but I tolerate it in shows like this because I'm invested in the characters. Like, if I don't care about the characters, even if I hate them and think they're awful people, you know, if I'm not invested in what's actually happening to them, if I don't believe that they're like real human beings, I'm out. Like, I don't have any interest in seeing that. And I think this show really strikes that perfect balance between that sort of character study and character arcs, which I think are really interesting, not just for Walt, of course, but for those minor characters, Skyler, even Walter Jr., Marie. So, and looking at those much more exciting action scenes.
Awesome. DEA all the way. I really like that one. I also liked, I'm heading to the 7-Eleven. You need me to pick up anything? Big gulp, Slim Jim.
Yeah. That moment is so cringe for me though. When when they're back from the hospital,
it's supposed
and
to be,
Hank
isn't
is,
it?
Yeah. And Walt, I said Hank, but when Walt is trying to make Skyler laugh and he's like, he strips naked and puts on his pork pie hat and he's like, I'm running up to 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
And she doesn't find the humor in it. And it's so cringy. Like, he's just trying to make it seem like everything's okay. And then he even tells her, like, it's me. I'm still me. You know, it's okay. And this, of course, is going to be a problem going forward, right? Like, Skylar's, like, neurotic to the point, like, she's afraid to leave him alone. She's worried that something like this could happen to him again. And who wouldn't be in her position, right? Which really starts to grate on his nerves, right? Like, the worst thing for Walt is like people feeling sorry for him or pitying him or something like that. And of course, this story that he's told, you know, that's going to attract that kind of attention from his family. So he dug his own grave there, really. And I don't know, that scene though with
yeah, I like the language too when they say that they need to confirm that it's a non-recurring event, you know, because it's sort of like, okay, well, yeah, that's not true. Like, everything around Walt is completely a recurring event now that he's on this path, right? More problems will come in every direction, guaranteed.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good way of thinking about it, right? Like, he is on that path forward where it's just going to be more shit. You know it is.
He's on and, that bad
poor
choice
Jesse.
Road.
Yeah, he really is. He really, or the bad choice rowboat, whatever. Yeah. All right. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on before we get into favorite lines, favorite shots?
I think we can probably go. I mean, I just sort of crossed off the other points I had in my notes right there. So what's your favorite line?
My favorite line. Okay. So I already mentioned that. Well, you guys know, if you've been listening, you know that this is impossible for me.
Yeah,
so I've already mentioned
it's our favorite spectrum of lines of things that, you know, we don't really, we're not really great at narrowing it down to one, but it's an ideal that we hope to one day achieve, I guess. Don't forget your pants. We'll be back right after this short break.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and What do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part three of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood, the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Fire up the RV. We're back with more Growth, Decay, Transformation.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was kind of torn between the two of the one that I mentioned from the psychiatrist, right? Like, this is your way of giving credibility to a lie. Yeah. And also the line that Walt says to Jesse about what's changed. So, I mean, they're not, like, my favorite line. There's some funny lines in this. They're really great lines that, like, you know, I could choose just because they made me laugh sort of thing. But In terms of, like, what's important to understanding the characters, the storyline and stuff like that, I have to go with probably what's changed, Jesse, because nothing has changed. And as you just said so eloquently, Pete, this is a recurring problem, isn't it? What about you? What was your favorite line?
Well, you know, I would agree with you that what's changed, Jesse, is the one, like the way it comes across in the thing, you know, like I think that's the best line of the episode. And I think the most important one is the one that you mentioned in about lending credibility to a lie. You know, that I saw that in the notes whenever I was doing my thing. So I didn't choose that one because I knew we'd end up talking about that a lot. But the one I did pick was, I went with what you were just saying, the one that made me laugh. And it was when they're whenever they're interviewing Wendy and she says, "It's you. I know you. You're the one in the black truck. You wanted me to do that kid, the kid with the crutches, the football player, specifically the football player part." Like, it's just, I guess I would think that's the, number one Wendy moment of the entire, her, you know, the entire character for me, maybe, because you don't really know what to expect. You know what I mean? Like, this isn't a person we're that familiar with, other than we know that she's a meth addict that hangs around at the place, you know what I mean? And she's a crucial part of this plan, and she really comes through with that. Like, I think that she, I don't think that was a plan, right? I think that she really realizes who he is in that moment. And
yeah.
The look on Hank's face and Gomi like saying like, what, like, what is this? It's just, it's a great, great comedic moment there.
Yeah.
What about shots? What'd you say?
Yeah, I was quoting Gomi when he calls Hank the ball pervert. You know, what was that about doing the kid? Yeah. I love the dialogue in this one. I really love this episode. I think this is a really great episode.
Peter Gould wrote it, right?
Yeah, he did. And the man knows how to write dialogue. I'm sorry. He just does. Not that the others don't, but, you know, there's such a gold mine here of things you could tell. We could just do like a really close line reading of the dialogue spoken in this one, but we put everyone to sleep.
It's snappy. It's really snappy. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like where it needs to just sort of wash over you, it does that. And then when it really needs to make a point, it does it like perfectly.
It does. A great episode. Very well written, very well shot. I love the cinematography in this one. So again, I already let you know from the outset that I had a hard time picking a favorite shot for this one. I really loved all the ones with the painting. So there are at least like three, maybe four prominent shots with this painting. And it really, I think if you go back and watch it and pay very close attention to those scenes, it really does give you some insight into how Walt is thinking and feeling at that particular moment. And again, this sort of disconnect between like what he's doing and how it's affecting his family. But there was this one shot, it's just a cool shot, and it's something that they do a couple times throughout the series. This one in particular is when they're in the hospital towards the end of the episode. Walt is about to be released and Hank comes in and he shows them the block of lucite with the grill in it, and the way he holds it up to show Walt and Junior.
It lines up with his mouth.
Yeah, it's positioned right over Walt's face. So it looks like Walt is wearing the grill himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, it's like one of those like wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Like Hank doesn't know, he doesn't recognize the criminality. And you know, the guy he's searching is the one standing right in front of him. And there's another shot similar to that later on. They've put together this collection jar to raise money for Walt, and Hank holds it up at one point, asking the DEA agents to donate. And he holds it up right in front of like one of those, you know, like the mugshot pictures in the back where it's got like the height. And it's so like Walt is lined up. It took me way too long to explain that. You guys know what I'm talking about, hopefully. Sorry. But yeah, like they do that at several points throughout the series. They also do stuff like that in Better Call Saul. It's very classic to this universe, I think.
I think those are tricky. I think those are tricky shots, too, because I think that, you know, I think like those are ones that when you're directing it, you know, you shoot them and you think, okay, if this works, we'll use it. But then you also shoot it in other ways just in case, so you can cover it up, because sometimes those can come off as being like corny or just too obvious or, you know, they take you out of whatever else is happening. But when they pull it off, like they do with this one here, it's super effective. For me, I was kind of like you. I was thinking about a lot of stuff. I didn't want to repeat myself on some of the ones that we had in previous ones. Like, I liked the shots of the desert. I liked the way that it made me think about all the other shots in the desert. And there was, you know, one where like you see like full on overhead, almost like a drone shot or something of them where they're, you know, they're cutting across and it all feels so desolate. But the one that I landed on was the shot of Jesse whenever they're at the Crystal Palace. And it's really the whole scene, you know, where he's getting ready for the DEA to, you know, he's anticipating their arrival, and you see him sort of lay back on the bed, and Aaron Paul does a really good job. There's a lot of shots about like around the room, and it's just such a dingy, weird place. You know what I mean? That gives such a creepy feeling about just being there in general. But then also when you think about the fact that you're gonna have the the cops show up, you know what I mean, and kick in the door. And I really like the sound design in this too, because there's this little thing where, you know, there's sort of like the din in the background that sort of builds up to the moment when you get that loud bang of the door opening or whatever. But there's a little that whenever Wendy does her last line, her last hit, you know what I mean? There's a little bit of silence there, and then you hear her root beer opening up, like the pop of the can. And I thought that was such a great detail. You know what I mean? Like what I like about this scene more than anything, I think, having just said all those words, was that the way that they put so much into this, because it's sort of just a transactional situation. You know, it's not terribly important if you think about the overall scheme of things. But I like that, you know, they really did. They made it really intense, really show what Jesse has to do in order to make this plan come through. Like, you know, it's not an easy situation for him. And all the stuff with Wendy really kind of sets up, you know, what we see in the PlayStation later. So that's what I went with. I really dig that one.
Poor Wendy. Will she ever get her root beer? You know,
I know it's a never ending quest for that sweet, sweet root beer for her, you know.
Yeah, it's like Craig Kettleman and his coffee in Better Call Saul. So yeah, there was just speaking of sound design, there was a song that plays when Walt comes back from breaking into his own house, you know, he sees Skylar and Junior in the kitchen, and he looks at them trying to make sure he's not, you know, he's being avoided. And I almost picked that as my favorite shot. Also, I'm just now remembering when he first breaks into the house, he comes in through the sliding glass doors in the kitchen, and like you can see, it's at nighttime, and you can see like the shadow and the light from the pool playing on the window behind him. So you can clearly see it's water behind him. So again, I was thinking about that stupid rowboat. But there's this song that plays at the end of that scene when he comes back into the hospital, and again he's looking at this robot painting, and it's called "Waiting Around to Die" by the Be Good Tanyas. And you know, thinking a little bit more about those song choices and why they include certain songs at certain moments, I think that one again also tells us something about Walt's state of mind and his point of view. And just two other things that occurred to me as we were talking, Pete, about the rowboat thing. It's been a while since I've seen this movie, but Good Will Hunting, there's a when Robin Williams' character first meets with Matt Damon's character, he notes the watercolor of like a rowboat on his windowsill. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you know that scene?
Yes. It's been a while since I saw it, but yeah, it's coming together. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and Matt Damon, if I remember correctly, he says something like he's criticizing it, and he's like, it's made in the style of like Winslow Homer, but it's like poorly done and yada yada yada. You know.
Yeah, I remember it pretty distinctly now.
Yeah, it's an important scene to the series, and like how Will understands that painting, and then Sean, played by Robin Williams, cracks a joke, you know, because like he's trying to be all cerebral about it and intellectual and talking about like why it's like such a shitty painting or whatever. And then he cracks a joke that it was like, you know, done paint by number or something like that, Sean does. But something interesting about that painting was that painting was actually painted by the director of that film, which is Gus Van Sant. So he actually made that for the film. And I was also thinking, again, it's always Coen Brothers. Did you ever see A Serious Man?
Yeah. It's one of my
favorite
Coen Brothers.
So A Serious Man, I love that movie. So, you know, when I saw Better Call Saul, Fun and Games, the first time we watched it through, I noticed the painting right away. I was like, oh my God, it's the same painting from Breaking Bad. But then I was like convinced that we saw this painting in A Serious Man. Like I was like, I've seen this painting somewhere else. So I like watched the movie. It's not in that movie, but there is a scene that's very similar to what happens when the brother Arthur is like, he goes like his brother, the serious man in the story, like the main character of the film, the protagonist, has a dream about his brother getting into this rowboat and then like sailing off to Canada because like he's wanted by like the feds for playing cards illegally or something like that. For those of you that haven't seen the film, but you know, it's this scene of him waving goodbye to his brother from the shoreline, and it's this happy, joyful moment. And then the brother gets shot by the racist, like Nazi neighbors. this is just a dream, right? So no spoilers there. But that also came to mind. So anyway, I wanted to end this one by asking the listeners, the audience, what do you think the painting means? How do you interpret it? Can you recall the scenes in this particular episode, but also in Gliding overall in season 5? What about in Better Call Saul in Fun and Games, where we see it in Jimmy and Kim's hotel room? Like, what do you think it means? How do you understand the painting? And we would love to hear from you. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to follow our podcast and hit that bell for notifications. Rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. And those who wish to support GDT can join our Patreon at patreon.com/growthdecaytransformation. You want to tell them how they can connect with us, Pete?
Yeah, you can find us on Twitter at BreakingBadGDT. That's where we post all of our updates, and we're checking that pretty regularly. Maybe not as much as the Gmail, but we're on there all the time. You can write us at the Gmail account. It's BreakingBadGDT@gmail.com. We like to read feedback. We could possibly end up doing a mailbag episode down the road if we get enough stuff there to warrant one. So if you have questions about the series, comments about what we're talking about, anything you would like to see us refer to in one of those kinds of episodes, then drop us a line there. You can find our producer Talitha on Instagram at Talitha_makes_things. And thanks for listening. Join us next week. We'll be discussing the episode 204, which is called Down.